Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. It's Travis, and today we're going to talk about what does the One Big Beautiful Bill Act mean for you? The OBBB, OBBB. So I'm going to try to, the Big Beautiful Bill is probably easier to say than three Bs for whatever reason for me. So we're going to talk about the Big Beautiful Bill and what does it mean? And we're going to talk about the impacts for student loan borrowers, just things you should be thinking about. And just know that by the time I recorded this, they were essentially in the middle of voting on passing it. So I'm assuming it's going forward. It certainly seems like it will be law. And the provisions in it are pretty much the provisions of the Senate parliamentarian, you know, struck down, and then they reissued the new bill. And that's basically the bill that got passed. This BBB or OBBB, this bill has some very bad things in it for student loan borrowers. It could have been way, way worse, though. And that's thanks to the Senate parliamentarian, who many people should probably send flowers to, basically, based off of how much she saved borrowers from the very worst impacts of this bill. There's some things that she didn't strike down, which is also kind of weird to me. So basically, the Senate parliamentarian, what is this and why? How did this all happen? Let's just start there. When you have a bill that comes from the House is usually the thing that bills get passed really easily and compared to the Senate. So the House is just the majority rules. There's no way to hold up bills like there is in the Senate. So if something has majority support, it gets voted on, it's passed, right? Then it goes to the Senate. Well, the Senate has something called the Byrd Rule, and that's basically the filibuster. And what it says is you have budget reconciliation, which is something that you can change tax and spending policy with 50 votes. And there's things that both parties try to put in those bills that don't meet the threshold for reasonable changes that you would be able to do with 50 votes. You need 60 votes for some of these bigger changes that have bigger, broader societal impacts. That's the easiest way I can describe it, I think. And who gets to be the arbiter of that? A nonpartisan Senate parliamentarian who gives advisory opinions to the Senate on what is considered part of the Byrd Rule and what is not, based off of the text that the parties submit to the parliamentarian. So the parliamentarian has been around for more than a decade. She started in 2012, and she's made rulings in some cases that have been overturned by the Senate. Basically, they ignore her advice. But in this case, the Senate decided to accept most of the parliamentarians, or pretty much all of the parliamentarians' advice about what should not be in the bill. And the things that are relevant for student loan borrowers are that the original version would really not have respected grandfathering in borrowers whatsoever. And then the version post-parliamentarian protects borrowers to allow them to pretty much keep their payment plan until July 2026, at which point anybody who's on any kind of ICR-derived repayment plan would be transitioned off of that, and that includes pay. They'd be transitioned off of that onto the income-based repayment plan for existing borrowers. Now, for new borrowers, those folks will be on the RAP plan post-July 2026. That's the plan that's 10% of income with some interest subsidies, allows you to file separate, and it's 30 years until forgiveness in the private sector. Existing borrowers get to keep old IBR and new IBR. Pay would be dead, and you would be put onto either old IBR or new IBR over time. And then the people would have to be on RAP past July 2026. And existing borrowers get to hang out in the plan that they're, you know, the IBR plan that they're in after that period of time. And you probably would not want to switch because you probably can't switch back out of RAP when you switch into it. RAP is not going to be available for several months. So there's no use in worrying about the math for now because, you know, we will have time to help people analyze this decision. It is a big decision, though, because the IBR plan, even the one that's 15% of income, in some cases is actually cheaper than the RAP plan that's 10% of income. And the reason is that what matters is 15% or 10% of what? The IBR plan is 15% of discretionary income, which is your AGI minus 150% of the poverty line for your family size. So for a family with like three or four kids, that deduction could be $50,000, $60,000 before they take 15% of the amount above that. The RAP plan is just 10% of your AGI minus $50 per month per kid. That's a way, way lower deduction. So in some cases, the IBR plan, even the old version of IBR, is better than the RAP plan. Another way the IBR plan could be better than the RAP plan is if you're in the private sector, you know, 25 years until forgiveness is lower than 30 years until forgiveness. And particularly those five final years of repayment would be on a higher salary for most people, especially professionals with dental or medical degrees or vet degrees, things like that. Student loans will remain complicated, maybe not quite as complicated as during the IDR waiver and PSLF waiver eras, but they will remain complicated. And the complexity actually takes on a new form. And let me explain what I mean by that. If you need to borrow after July 2026, what it looks like, and I have to double check this in the bill, okay, 900 pages, you have to kind of think through it. It does not instantly seem obvious, right? But what I'm seeing right now is that if you borrowed after July 2026, you'd basically be stuck with the RAP plan. If you wanted to pay back new loans on an IDR plan, it'd have to be the RAP plan for everything. And if you have no other option, it's better than not having another option. So if you're, you know, needing to borrow two more years for dental school at NYU and you're going to have $700,000 of student debt by 2028, well, yeah, the RAP plan is going to be a lot better than any other option. So you probably just need to suck it up and do it because it's the best of the bad options. But for folks that start in the fall of 2026 and later, the math of student loans becomes very complicated, and I'll tell you why. You can still borrow 200 grand. That's not an insignificant amount of debt. 200 grand is still a lot of debt. So most people in professional school, frankly, are going to max out at 200K of loans in the federal government, and then they will absolutely, in most cases, need to borrow an additional amount of money in the private loan market. So graduate loans now will have a large private loan market, and the underwriting for this is going to be wild because you're going to need people to be able to borrow. Underwriting for undergrad loans is done based on the parents' credit score and credit profile. For graduate degree holders, in many cases at top MBA programs, it's based off of just the program and the future expected earnings of the graduates, but those are two-year programs. So it's going to be real interesting to see what kind of market develops for graduate loans post fall of 2026, in particular for dental and medical and veterinary that are four-year programs where people might need to borrow $20,000, $30,000, or even $40,000 a year extra for their loans. And that's going to make for some real interesting, you know, repayment strategies, things like intentionally keeping your federal loan payments as low as you possibly can to maximize interest subsidies while directing everything you've got at your private student loans to get rid of that big danger. Because private student loans are definitely the most challenging, the most difficult of the loans that we encounter, because there's just no flexibility whatsoever except for restructuring the loan with the refinancing to maybe a longer repayment term. So we're going to have a lot of people out there being challenged with private student loans for graduate school in the future, and that's not good news at all. Now, does the math still support going to a medical or dental program? Yes. Does the math support going to a veterinary program? Probably yes in most cases. Does the math support going to some of these other professional degree required programs if you're going to borrow private student loans on top of federal programs like pharmacy, physical therapy, chiropractic, PA, occupational therapy, et cetera, law? And the answer is it's going to be, really, it depends. I mean, you know, you could maybe make an argument that unless you're able to go to a top five law school or a public law school that is affordable, that maybe under these new loan rules, law school just doesn't make sense at all unless you come from a wealthy family. You might make the same argument based off of many of those other medical professions that I described. Because ultimately, let's say you go to a private pharmacy school and you're borrowing 200K of federal loans and you need to borrow another 100K of private. So you got 300K of loans. They have to be paid back because the federal amounts are, you know, 200K on 120K base salary over a 30-year repayment period. I have to double check the math, but you're probably going to be forced to pay that back. And so if you have 300K of loans, it's basically, think about it as a $3,000 a month payment obligation, and it's not tax deductible. And if you're making 120K after taxes, maybe that's 90. So 90K of take-home pay, you're losing 36K of that to student loans. You're netting 54. Does it make sense after taxes to go to 4 years or 3 or 4 years of school for something that's paying you 54 after taxes when you could just go get an undergrad degree and go into the workforce? So that math basically no longer makes sense. You're probably going to be in a situation where the only professional schools you should borrow for are ones that would put you in a 1.5 debt to income ratio or lower, where you could primarily or entirely do it with only that 200K of federal loans or less. And that's going to be really hard. And a lot of programs are not set up for that at all. And a lot of programs, frankly, have built their entire budgets and their entire schools based off of, you know, this expectation of unlimited student loan borrowing with no cap. And that's going to be not affecting people going to school this fall because you're grandfathered in if you're going this fall. But for next fall, I predict a couple of things. Schools are going to intentionally start people's enrollments in these programs in June 2026 instead of July 2026, because it says you have to be, you know, for anybody that's a new borrower after July 2026. So I predict a whole bunch of graduate professional schools are going to do this trick where they enroll people in June of 2026 to get them 3 years of access to the old loan limits, which will be unlimited until, you know, mid-2029, right? And then you would have 1 year of private student loans you'd have to borrow. And everybody would want to do that for one final year they have to borrow to be able to finish their degrees. That's kind of like a no-brainer in terms of whether or not you would do that if that was your only option, right? So I think that a lot of graduate programs are going to sucker people in with this start you in June 2026 strategy. But, you know, after that date, let's say we're in, you know, spring of... let's say we're fall 2027 at this point. Well, now there's no way around it. You can only borrow $50,000 a year for professional school. So even in your law students, you can't borrow $200 over 3 years. It's really $50,000 over 3 years because of the $50,000, you know, per year limit. So no, you're only able to borrow $150,000. Well, living expenses are like $25,000 or $30,000, and there's no adjustment for inflation in this bill. So you're borrowing $25,000 for living expenses. Are you going to be able to pay tuition, fees, books for $25,000 per year? I mean, I don't know that many law schools in the country where you can do that. Maybe public ones, a couple, few public ones, but that's pretty much it. So the math of people being able to go to graduate school and professional school is just going to be dramatically different with this bill. The impact is going to be not felt for a couple of years, and it will be felt because President Trump is in office until the, you know, January 2029, right? So there's no way that Democrats could take control of Congress in 2026 and pass something over his veto, right? So these are definitely going to go into effect, and it's going to lead to, really, I think in a lot of cases, mass layoffs in graduate and professional schools over the next couple of years and mass school closures in the next couple of years. And, you know, sometimes what is going to happen, of course, is the university itself will continue to stay open, but they'll shut down their pharmacy school or something like that. Again, we talked about the bad things about hurting economic mobility that would occur because of this change. I almost like feel weird or guilty even talking about this because it feels like it just feels a little inappropriate to say. But I'll say it just because I think it's important to just be able to call balls and strikes and explain what the impacts are of something economically, even if it's awkward to talk about. And what I mean with that is just the impact on supply of providers and salaries. So what's going to happen with this bill, I think, is it's going to lead, I believe, over the course, if it stays in place over several years, it's going to lead to higher salaries for professional school degree holders. And the reason is, it's just economics 101. If you limit the supply of a pool of labor, it raises the price of what you have to pay to attract that pool of labor. So if you have, you know, 12,000 pharmacy school graduates a year before this bill, and that number goes down to 6,000 pharmacy school graduates after the bill, you know, if you're introducing 6,000 fewer PharmD holders into the market over the course of 5-6 years, it wouldn't happen right away where there'd be huge impacts on the labor market. But 5-6 years in, you've got way fewer providers than what the labor market's used to. You probably still have unchanged demand or slightly higher demand. So that's essentially going to have to incentivize people to work more hours. So you're going to have higher salaries, right? You're going to have higher hourly wages. You're going to have more accommodations in the workforce for better working conditions, right? You'll have more ability for people to have leverage in their job conditions negotiations. Things like, you know, do you get a lunch break or not? Do you get an admin day or not? Do you get a certain amount of vacation? Or is there any wiggle room in that negotiation? So ultimately, you know, that's what determines wages and earnings is supply demand, right? And so the bill will drastically cut down the supply of providers, which means a higher leverage and higher salary potential, I think, among professionals long term. Now, you might think, well, that doesn't help. I don't care about that at all. That's okay. I'm not saying you should or should not care about it. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying it's the right thing or a good thing. I'm just saying I think this is what's going to happen. And for undergrad schools, I think a lot of those will shut down too. The new aggregate limit for Parent Plus is just $65,000 in aggregate. It's like $20,000, I think, per student or something like that. I mean, it's extremely, extremely low. And what will parents do if, you know, basically you're going to have to tell your kid no. That's what this short answer is if they want to go to some high priced school, you're going to have to either empty the equity in your home or you're going to have to say no with this new bill because it's just not going to be enough for people to pay for these undergrad programs. You know, like I think Duke University is something like, I don't know, $70,000 a year, something crazy high like that. Notre Dame, I think, is $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year. people were financing that with Parent Plus in many cases, especially people that made too much money to qualify for need-based aid. You know, you would just have to, maybe you got a good package too for your first year or something, and the kid goes to school for a year. You tell yourself, oh, I'm going to figure it out for the first year. And they go there and they make friends, they make progress, they're moving along in their degree. And then you say, oh, shoot, I don't have enough to finance the rest of these 3 years. What do I do now? And your choices are, well, the kid has to drop out, or you figure out a way to pay for it. And a lot of people took the path of least resistance, which is just say yes to Parent Plus loans, because at least they stay in school and you figure it out later because the payments are deferred. That's a dirty little secret of undergrad programs, is just that's what financial aid departments did to avoid tough conversations that were honest and direct about whether or not the kid could stay in school. Financial aid would just say, well, it's just, we get paid if we get people Parent Plus loans. The parents have deferred payments until the kids graduated, and at that point, it's not a problem anymore. That was the prevailing attitude, I think, and is the prevailing attitude in most financial aid departments, not maybe among the rank and file. Like, I think people are just trying to do their job, but, you know, leaders of those departments have a job to do, which is to pay the bills of the university, which is to get the money they need to have people be enrolled, right? And if you're going to say, you're not going to say, I think your kid should drop out. That's just like an awkward conversation that people just don't want to have. So they're just going to say, well, how do we keep your kid enrolled? Okay, let's take out Parent Plus loans, because that's the option we can do. But with this change, that option is going to go away for anybody entering school next fall. Not this fall, but next fall, the opportunity to borrow unlimited Parent Plus loans goes away. And again, if you're one of these like regional schools with very limited funds for financial aid, how are these parents going to pay for this? Like, the parents are not going to be able to pay for huge amounts of private student loans because the banks won't underwrite it. They just are going to say, I'm not going to underwrite somebody making $100,000 a year for $200,000 of private loans for their child. Like, I'm not going to do it. That's what the banks are going to say. So there will be a lot of really tough conversations that are going to happen. I remember the movie Lady Bird in particular, because I think her dad like emptied his home equity to pay for her NYU degree or something like that. I don't remember that movie that well, but I think that there is a real conversation that's going to have to happen among a lot of families of what families can afford and what they can't. I mean, that's kind of what happened with me. My parents were just like, hey, we can afford a state school, but that's it. And if you want to try to go somewhere else, you got to join the military. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but that was just the conversation that, you know, they had with me. And it was just sort of some early life tough love of what my options were, right? But of course, if you're like, you know, Lady Bird's dad, and you decide to empty your home equity to go to send the child to NYU, that's your choice, right? Free country, you can make the decision you want to make. Just know that it's going to be way tougher. You know, it's going to be a return to the pre-2006 era of student loans, except at much higher interest rates and much, much, much higher prices for these programs. So, I mean, we will probably see drastic price cuts too. I mean, some of these schools, the reason they charge unlimited pricing for grad school is because they can. For undergrad, they actually engage in tons of aggressive price discounting, and they actually dress it up as merit scholarships. Actually, that's not really true. It's mostly a lie. The merit scholarships are what they call a merit scholarship to make somebody feel good. What's really going on is they have a complex formula that they calculate exactly what they think each family will pay, and they charge you what they think you will pay based off of your financial aid and your, you know, test scores, all these things. And they give you a price that is very carefully calibrated based off of what they think you're going to pay. So I think you're going to start seeing some competition in price from grad school that'll happen over time from this bill. And I think you'll also see a higher average household wealth of the families that send their kids to professional school, because other families from lower and middle income backgrounds won't be able to afford it, which is very unfortunate, but it's the reality. So for borrowers thinking about what comes next, you know, what about tax stuff? What about filing taxes, separate, joint, et cetera? I think the importance of filing taxes the right way is now more important than ever with this bill passing, because the RAP plan allows you to file separate. The IBR plan allows you to file separate. And with people losing pay, people are going to lose 15% of their income instead of 10 if you borrowed your first loan between October 2007 and July 2014. So that's most people in their 30s. Would be impacted by that one. There's a big cohort of borrowers in that 30-something-year-old category that are going to be going from 10% of income to 15% of income. Now, that's one thing I just don't understand with the parliamentarian, because that is hurting current borrowers. That is changing the rules midstream on current borrowers. And the Senate bill eliminates the ICR statute, and she didn't think that was a problem. She didn't strike that down, but she struck other stuff down. So why did she allow that to fly? I don't know. But current borrowers are being hurt. And perhaps the explanation is because the pay program was promised by an executive branch action, not a legislative branch action, and the parliamentarian has no say over that. So maybe that's the answer, but I'm not sure why. But, you know, if you're losing 15% of your income instead of 10, because you essentially have a tax hike that goes on if you're going for forgiveness and you're in this 2007 to 2014 pay borrower kind of status, you know, what do you do? Well, you got to pay attention to how you're putting your money in your savings accounts. Are you subject to taxes in your interest income? Are you subject to taxes on tax inefficient assets in your brokerage account? You know, are you bleeding yourself with very tax inefficient assets and your taxable accounts more so than other people would? Because if you think about it, if you're making, I think it's over 400,000, you're in the, as a couple, you're in the 32% tax bracket. That's pretty much, you know, two dentists or two physicians that are married to each other. You know, if you're in 32% federal bracket, let's say you're in 5 to 10% state, so you're at like 40 already, and then throw on 15 from IBR. So now you're at 55. Now throw on 4% if this is investment income, because you're over the 250K household income level for the ACA surcharge tax. So now you're at 59, and then throw on like additional Medicare tax or whatever. Now you're like at 60. I have to double check on that additional Medicare tax. I'm just kind of riffing. But that's basically 60% overall that you're losing to tax on investment income. That's horrific. That's terrible. That's like what people were losing in the 60s and 70s back when whole life insurance was all the rage. And that's kind of why that a lot of these variable annuity and, you know, insurance products got created in the first place, is because marginal tax rates were like 60, 70, 80%. And, you know, realizing income from dividends and interest was so costly from a tax perspective, people built all these products that could allow you to, you know, have the gains compound inside of a tax deferred vehicle instead of being a taxable brokerage. Now, I am not suggesting everybody go out and buy high fee whole life and variable annuity products at all. Hear me out when I say that. What I am saying, though, is traditional, conventional types of retirement accounts are more important now than they used to be. So things like pre-tax retirement accounts, it's a lot more important that you max out all your pre-tax accounts, including your HSAs. It's a lot more important than it used to be that you maximize your backdoor Roth IRAs and automate it, or even do a mega backdoor Roth if you have that option, or do your 457B if you're in a, you know, hospital setting, right? So all these tax-protected ways to invest and save are just a lot more important than they ever were before because of the changes that are present in this bill. Even though starting a tax business was incredibly painful, I'm glad we did it, because it's just other firms are not set up to provide the specialized advice. Hopefully we'll have space for new clients. Right now we don't, because of constraints on who wants to do taxes in the labor market. Honestly, it's tough out there to find a really competent preparer that checks all the boxes, that is also, you know, having a reasonable salary that's, you know, affordable to pay. I mean, you know, a lot of tax talent just goes to the big firms serving the wealthiest people, and they can afford to pay more than firms like us. So, you know, if we're able to open up space for new tax clients, I'll call that out in a podcast here. But for the ones who are existing tax clients, you know, hopefully you'll feel relief as we grow into that business and, you know, have a couple seasons under our belt and can help people handle the chaos, this new tax bill. There's also some big tax changes that's probably more in the purview of what we would discuss in the SLP Wealth podcast, but there's changes in this bill, things like affecting, you know, who would itemize and who wouldn't itemize. And when you itemize, you need to keep track of everything you do, instead of when you take standard deduction, you can kind of ignore most things you do because you're not itemizing anyway. But if you're itemizing, you need to keep track of, you know, all the charitable contributions, all the, you know, miles driven, and, you know, all these different things that you might maybe ignore, your state taxes you pay, your property taxes, right? So there's more things to keep track of when you are talking about these changes that are going to happen to this tax bill compared to what things were before. And we will remain here to help. We will do our very best to answer all of your questions about this bill. I'm sure some people are going to want to see the numbers themselves. We do already have an RAP calculator built that we're using in consults, comparing it to the old and new IBR plans and the pay plan, showing people the math compared to paying it off. So if you want a post One Big Beautiful Bill Act consult, you can go to studentloanplanner.com/book. And if you have questions, of course, about the bill, you can go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail and ask a question for the show. And if you are a wealth client, just ask your planner if you have any questions. It's probably not a bad idea to enjoy the summer, let some stress roll off our backs with this bill now that we have more certainty as to what the rules of the road are going to be for the next basically 3 years. at a minimum, right? That's how soon you would potentially have a Democratic presidential administration that would change all of this. We will keep you updated. We will keep you updated on the loopholes, what you need to know, and we'll try to do it by telling some dad jokes to keep things entertaining. Thank you so much for following the Student Loan Planner podcast. Share it with a friend if you know of anybody that also is going through this loan journey, and hope you have a great rest of your week. Are you on the free Student Loan Planner email list? If yes, you can upgrade your experience and discover student loan loopholes so good, they might get repealed if I talk about them publicly. Find out my very best thought leadership that I really just can't be super open about anymore, unfortunately. If you want to get our very best tips, not just the ones that I can share for free, go to studentloanplanner.com/insider to get a special discount for your year membership. That's studentloanplanner.com/insider and get our very best dozens of bonus content and tips that's going to save you money and get you out of student debt faster. And if you're already an SLP insider, please reply back to those emails and let me know how I can make it even more valuable.